So, hello once again. I thought it would be nice, given that Hogan passed away yesterday, to maybe speak a little bit about him and his teachings tonight. We did in the study group once, we studied one of his texts that José Eduardo had shared. I can't even remember what it was, but from what I've read, and José Eduardo gave me a couple of his books and just things that I've read about him, he was very direct, and one of his most common sayings was just this, which is very much the way that we practice in our Sangha as well, is it's just this. Apparently when he first came to the West, he'd been trained in traditional Japanese Soto Zen, and when he first came to the West, he realized that all of these forms and rituals that were so rigorously practiced in Japanese monasteries would have little meaning for Westerners, and that he had to find some other way to bring them the teachings and help them to practice. And so he really put emphasis on, as we do, everyday life, non-monastic practices, although he did create a center in the Sierra Nevada in Spain, which actually I'm going to visit, ironically, in May, for the first time, which was not a monastery, but it was a retreat place. And so there's an affinity too, and maybe that's why people in Portugal said that it was similar to what we do, is that there was not this insistence on monastic practice and rituals in to the extent that there are in some other Zen groups. And I found this quote from him that I will read, where he it's taken from a passage in his book. But so he said, "What is real practice? We can easily assume the posture of Zazen, but not really practice, but not actually practice. So we can, we can actually, it's easy to sit and sit in Zazen, but it's possible to do that and not actually practice." He says, "Real practice is very simple and at the same time, very profound. It's nothing more or less than freedom from concepts and beliefs about everything, even those about practice itself." So I think we can recognize this. He's pushing us to let go of everything, all of our ideas, to really plunge into not knowing, which is, he doesn't use that word not knowing, but that's where he's sending us. And his, I said his thing was just this. And he also was, he had another phrase, which was the concrete this. Concrete this, not a conceptual this, but concrete this, which is located now. Its location of the concrete this is now. And he had, I came across this exchange that he had with a student where the student was asking something like, so, it was during a retreat and a session, and the student was saying, how can I, will I someday be aware? How can I gain awareness or something like that? And so Hogan said, "The most advanced moment is now. So the farthest moment possible is now." And then he says, "So why not now? Why not?" to the student. And the student remained silent. And Hogan then said, "Will you be aware after this session? Is that it? Where are you now?" So constantly pushing to now. So when he asks this question, which you can't really answer, like, why not now? He forces the student into this present moment of there's you can't really answer that. Why not now? The only response is to just be here now. And that challenges our projections of, oh, it will happen later, or there was something before and there will be something after. It's just now, just this right now. And that is that, that joins his what is real practice of letting go of all ideas and beliefs. Just this now. And this, I like this notion of the most advanced moment is now. That takes away all of our projections of attaining something later. This is the farthest along we can possibly go now. And it's always new. So every moment is as far as we can go, and every moment is full, and every moment is here, and then it's not. And then there's another moment, and another moment, and another moment, or one continuous moment, say, maybe. But it's always now. So in a sense, Hogan was true to he thought, he from what I could have seen in his books is he really felt that he was carrying on Dogen's teachings. Although other lineages, other teachers who carry on Dogen's teachings emphasize the posture, the kesa, the rituals. They would not point to just now. So it's interesting that Hogan could point to just now, just this. Don't worry about the postures. You can do a perfect posture and not be actually practicing if you are not truly here. And he firmly believed this was Dogen's message, which fits with my interpretation of what Dogen's message is too. So maybe I have this affinity for Hogan in that sense. Now, because I never met him and I have no idea what his retreats were actually like. I have no idea what his Dharma talks were like. I haven't found any recordings or heard of any recordings. There probably are. He had quite extensive, long, big Sangha practices in Australia and has actually a successor in Australia, at least one, and founded a Sangha called Open Way Zen. And then disappeared. And was rumored to be in Spain, but no one knew exactly where. And even his family, according to Lisa and Jose Eduardo, say that even his family didn't know exactly what was happening with him. And I'm not quite sure what that means, that he would disappear like that. In terms of teaching, I don't know what that is. He did. José Eduardo lost his Rakusu once. After the first retreat that José Eduardo did with Wildflower, which was in 2007, actually, it was the second retreat, but the first week-long retreat. It was a very intense retreat and in the middle of nowhere. And on his way south to Tavira, he lost his Rakusu. He thinks he left it on the train, but he never found it again. And he was devastated by this and thinking, is this a message? Should I he was desperate. He hadn't heard from Hogan for years and was ready to give it up and wondering, oh, should so is this a sign that I should forget Hogan and practice with Amy and Wildflower, and I should drop my attachments to, having this teacher, Hogan, whatever. But he was very upset about it. And so he eventually wrote to Hogan, and people would write to him from time to time, and they would just write to whatever random address they still had for him. And eventually, I don't know after how long, but eventually José Eduardo received a package in the mail, and Hogan had sent him a new rakusu, which is the rakusu that he still wears today, José Eduardo. But I think José Eduardo never heard from him again after that. And that was probably, I don't know, 15 years ago or something. His presence is still very much felt in Portugal. Gena Roshi told me that when she went to Auschwitz, she went several times to Auschwitz, the Auschwitz retreat with Bernie. I only went once, the first year, but she went several times with, and Michelle too. And she said that once when she was there, Hogan was there at the Auschwitz retreat. And I really doubted that. I thought that doesn't sound like, that doesn't sound like it. But it's true. I did find later that he, when she first told me that, I was thought she was mistaken or there was another Hogan or something. But then I did come across once something in one of his books where he mentions that he went to the Auschwitz retreat, to a retreat at Auschwitz, and there were 95 people sitting on the tracks and whatever. So his presence is still alive and well, I think, even though he is not. His body is not. I wrote to back to José Eduardo and said, asked him to please represent Wildflower at the funeral and to, express our condolences to him, to his family, for and our deep gratitude for Hogan's life and practice and for their life and practice, because his wife and son and Lisa's friend continue the temple, the family temple in Japan. Maybe Lisa can say something more about that because I don't really know that much about it. Do you want to say something, Lisa? You've been there, actually.
Yeah, this is strange. I mean, strange news. Because yes, he'd disappeared for a long while now, and family didn't have any news. They knew he was in Spain, but it was a weird situation. And so he comes from, he was, I think, given a temple in Japan to take care of, but like a family, a village temple, so like a church in Europe. So he was taking care of the, so in Japan they take care of the dead people, of the dead, and so they have a cemetery and an altar, and they do all the yearly celebrations for the dead. And they receive gifts from and money with rice from the village people who pay them to take care of the dead. And so it's a really small place in the, like an hour and a half away from Tokyo, an hour south, and very simple. And yeah, and he lived there with his wife and three kids, two son and a daughter who died. Daughter died, and they used to all live together there. And now it's only Mochomichi, so my friend Marta's husband, his wife, and his two grandson. And yeah, and it's that's and then but he was trained in a call, a name called Obama. And that's where we had made the connections with João. That's where his teacher was, João from Dana. And that's where he was trained. And I guess he left a long, long time ago. He left his wife and family to teach, to bring Zen to the West, to Portugal. And I don't think he's been there. He's been back there in a long, long, long time. He was back, yeah. Anyway, so that's where he comes from this tiny little place in the middle of nowhere, in a very traditional Japanese village, and in charge of, yeah, taking care of the village's dead. So all I can say, I don't know him. I've never met him.
Thank you, yeah. But you do know his son, I guess, through his
Son who's a very sweet and doesn't talk much and doesn't speak English, so it's difficult to communicate. Yeah. But he's very, very nice.
Can I say something?
Yes, please do, Anna.
Hello, everybody. I was with Marta and Eduardo one of these days in Lisbon, and as I wrote to Lisa, I invited Marta to come last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, because she's here in Lisbon. For seeing his mother and his brother, I mean Marta. I'm talking about Marta, which is Motsomichi. I don't know how to say the name of his husband. And she's here with one of their son. But Marta didn't. She said, Zoom Zendo is not for her, so she said no, thank you, but it's not for me. I was sad because it was a surprise, a surprise for everybody, special to Lisa. But well, she made this position. She is very. I know Marta for a long time because, as you know, she is his father was Pedro Moraes, you know, our friend that I speak sometimes, and I'm also close to her mother, and she told me that Hogan died. Another thing, Pedro used to say that once I saw Hogan making some yoga, because he practiced yoga since the end of his life. He was very, very, very thin, but he would practice this kind of yoga, and Pedro invented a word for the way Hogan practiced yoga. He said yogan. He practiced yogan. It's not yoga, it's yogan. It was like something like a dance with the postures, but like a dance, because he was very light. I met last week with Marta and her mother and Zé Eduardo. We had some tea, and it was very funny because When I arrived, Zeidward was in the table, and the two of them were in the table, and they couldn't recognize them because they don't see for years. They don't see each other for years. So I was a bit late, and I found Zeidward, and I said, "They both are there. You look for them." And so, Marta is like this, and her mother is like, and so they met, and afterwards I arrived, and then they begin, Eduardo and Marta, they began a conversation that me and Leia, which is her mother, we couldn't follow. You know, it was something that we were completely outside, and it was. And they didn't see each other for years, but they had, you know, this Hogan life and experiences and changing and the sangha. They spoke about, you know, a lot of people, but me and Leia, we couldn't understand nothing. So we kind of begin another conversation, but they were very pleased to remember all those experiences, and Marta put Eduardo a bit. She gave him a lot of news that he really didn't imagine. So that's what I can say about the Hogan's sangha. I also know that Pedro, our friend, he would not really sit because he said that he was always in practice, you know. And in the house with the family, I mean his wife and the son and her daughter Marta, he would just make some signs if he was with himself and he wanted and he didn't want to be interrupted. Even if he was washing dishes or something, he would just make a sign, and he said, "And we went on," and that's the way he practiced. Well, sometimes he used to sit, but he said that he didn't need to create this moment. And he said also, Pedro said also that Lourdes Castro, that was, you know, Lourdes Castro, Amy, you know, she said, he also said that her life, or everything she did was her practice. She also didn't create a space or a time for that. It was everything. So that is what I can share. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's you know, so Hogan is of the generation of Zen pioneers, really, who brought the practice from Japan to the West. Set up big monasteries and great huge sanghas, and wrote many books and became very famous, and others not, but each branch is as important, you know, and each each one its own way. And he, I feel like Hogan is truly one of the pioneers, who I personally had not heard of until I went to Japan, to Portugal. But I wouldn't have no reason to, because I don't think he ever came to France. But everyone in Portugal, pretty much, who's involved in the Zen or Buddhist world, has heard of Hogan. That's the kind of presence that he established. So,
Vítor Pomar also was a
exactly.
member,
That's right. Yeah.
but I think he was apart for long, long time for many reasons. Eduardo, he spoke a bit about that, about deep reasons. He was a bit apart, but he was a member.
Yeah, Vítor Pomar is another Portuguese artist. Yeah, Tiago.
Hi. I think when I started practicing Zen in Porto, the group was called Caminho Aberto, Open Way. So before Wildflower was Wildflower. And I remember José Eduardo read the Hogan's books to us. We had like Saturdays of practice sometimes with readings. And I remember Hogan's books, but I don't remember the books, but I remembered it was his books. And José Eduardo read them. That's my earliest memories of practices, José Eduardo reading. Yeah, in a very small room at Buddhist Union in Porto.
Yeah, I remember when he did that, José Eduardo. Yep. And that was very important. A lot of people came through from Porto, through that group, that with Margarita. He did that with Margarita. Yeah.
I just wonder how you, I don't think I know how you come from all the way from Japan to Lisbon, you to the US. That sort of makes sense. But to Portugal, how do you know how he, why, no?
I have no
I
idea.
ask Marta. I don't.
José Eduardo may know too, yeah. I have no idea. And I don't know if he came to Spain before Portugal. I don't know, because the center they have there in the mountains is in Spain. But I don't know. It's mysterious, isn't it? Probably someone invited him, though. That's usually what happens. Yeah.
And maybe it's through Manuel Zimbo, Lord de Castro's husband.
Who went to Japan or something, or
Don't know, but I think he's the one who sort of initiated the movement. I know. Yeah. Anyway, and so.
Yeah. Usually it's some an invitation. You know, that's how I ended up in Portugal, was because I was invited, but so somebody heard of him and brought him there or something. And I don't even know when exactly, but I know in the 90s he was in Australia already. So, and I think still has, it's still a thriving community in Australia, I think.
Marta's husband, Lisa, tell me the name. I cannot say. I cannot spell.
Motomichi.
Motomichi. He gave a workshop many years ago, he gave a workshop of origami with Marta for the students of the school where I worked, and Pedro too. He gave a wonderful workshop, origami workshop. He was very, very calm and very patient with the people, and they made very complicated origamis, very, very complicated. I still keep some. And also calligraphy. He made another workshop, and I have this memory of it was the only time I met Marta's husband, but I had this memory of him very patient and very clear, like Marta. She speaks, when she speaks, she's very, very clear. She says the right words. It's very impressive. I also want to say something that the two son Marta's the two boys, they don't speak any Portuguese or any English, and so that now Marta is left, and the Marta's mother stays with his grandson, communicating by gestures, because by non-verbal language, because he doesn't speak a word of Portuguese or English, he just speak Japanese. And she said that they communicate quite well.
Just to say, Hogan must have come to Portugal the first time in 1987. Some time ago I helped José Eduardo with an article about Buddhism in Portugal, and I did a little bit, and I did some research. I talked with him, of course, and I talked to several people. I was just checking to what I sent him a couple of months ago, 1987, in Algarve.
Okay. Wow. Okay, so later than I thought, huh? Yeah. Well, he was located in the concrete this now, and made his presence felt in a short time, you know, and left a real legacy in a very short time then. You know, it probably lasted 10 years or something maximum, his time in Portugal and Spain. I don't know. So what does that mean for us? You know, if the only thing we can retain from it is that what is real practice, you know, it's nothing. Nothing more or less than freedom from concepts and beliefs about everything. That's radical. It's really radical. But Zen is a radical practice, as we know. It's subversive. It overthrows all of the established order of things so that we can be free, so that everyone can be free. Not just our individual selves. So if we can see Hogan's life as, you know, we can question some of his choices of leaving his family, leaving his country, leaving his temple, leaving behind, you know, a lot of disciples in Portugal and Spain, and then leaving behind a bunch of disciples in Australia. We can question that, but can we appreciate whatever it is that he brought with us, with that, you know, whatever, you know, that he pointed us to what is real practice, too. and then have gratitude for his life and work, you know, and that of his family. That's what I said to José Eduardo. Yeah. Grateful for his family as well. And then helps us to appreciate our families and our Sangha and our practice and our teachers. And can maybe inspire us to carry on and do what we do in our way, in our branch. Someone today I had a staff meeting for the course that I teach for Buddhist leaders about boundaries. And one of the teachers in the course is one of the oldest members of White Plum, you know, one of, I think she's the fourth successor of Maizumi Roshi. She's 80 years old. And she was saying how at one point she had, after Maizumi Roshi died, she started practicing with, she already had received transmission from Maizumi Roshi, but she started practicing with another Japanese teacher. And she had been teaching for 20 years or something, and she had no successor, and she had no successor even in sight, you know. And so she was talking to this Roshi about this, and he said something like, I forget exactly how it was phrased, but the point was that she was worried about her little, quote, branch of this big tree of, you know, the path of liberation, you know, and this particular Zen way of doing it. And he said, every branch, can you see it as you, whatever you do is supporting that whole tree. So that, and for her, that took off so much pressure of her worrying about her little branch, little, I put little in quotes, about her branch, her successor. Instead of thinking of it in the larger terms of contributing to the wider tree of the path of liberation. And we don't know what the effects of that are. And she said that was such a relief for her. She now, with her, she co-teaches with her husband. They have seven successors, and they have a huge monastery in the U.S. So there's some relief involved. But she said at that time when he said that to her, that was a huge relief. And it shifted how she looked at her practice, which kind of joins with what our study in the study group, the text we've been looking at. I think there's only Lisa who's been in the study group, but our practice is not about individual awakening. It's impossible. If you wake up, it's impossible to just be worried about yourself. So, and also, can we then, you know, as Hogan says, let go of our concepts and beliefs about everything, even about practice? So what is practice? Was Hogan's practice good or not? Are we judging, should he have done something differently? Or should we do something differently? If we're true to our way, if we're true to ourselves and we let go of our ideas and concepts, then we're doing what we need to do. And we don't know what the consequences of that will be. We don't know where those ripples will go. You know, it's like throwing stone in water. You don't know where those ripples will go. So, maybe we can stop on that note. Unless someone wants to add something. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your practice. Thank you for your dedication to the concrete, this located now.